This is November 2nd, 2008, and with the national elections just 2 days from now, and Jukai later this month, I'm going to talk today about abortion and the conservative-liberal divide. And this came from a regular radio program on NPR called Speaking of Faith. It's Sunday mornings between 7 and 8. And last month, October, there were two consecutive programs on this program. There was two consecutive treatments of this topic called The Faith Life of the Party. And in the first one, October 2nd, an Amy Sullivan, a national correspondent for Time magazine, was interviewed by Krista Tippett, the host of Speaking of Faith. And in the second one, she calls herself a liberal evangelical. And the second weekend, October 9th, Rod Dreher was interviewed, and he considers himself a conservative, but not in some of the ways that many people have come to think of conservatism. And the purpose of this two-part interview was to, these two interviews, was to see into the religious aspects of conservatism, liberalism, below the surface. And it was, I really found it quite interesting, especially the second one, the conservative speaker. So, and then they, and he in particular, they both get into abortion and gay marriage, but especially abortion, as kind of the real, real irreconcilable issue between those who consider themselves conservatives and liberals generally. This Amy Sullivan first. Again, she considers herself a liberal evangelical. She said that religion wasn't always a factor in politics, especially presidential politics. But today, a presidential candidate, has to be religious. And she attributes this to the fallout from Watergate and the moral failings of the Nixon administration. And she suggests that religion, especially evangelical religion, became a proxy for one's moral groundings. She pointed out something I didn't know, that John Kerry, was a deeply devout Catholic who attends Mass at least once a week, but did not feel comfortable talking about it. Whereas Obama, and also McCain, she feels, and it seems to me this is true, that McCain doesn't feel comfortable talking about his religiosity in public, whereas Obama clearly does feel, Obama and Clinton, especially Clinton, but Obama also are more comfortable than most previous Democratic presidents, other than Carter, in talking about their religion and religion in general. This Amy Sullivan, said that the selection of Sarah Palin as McCain's running mate has highlighted the double standard by which the two parties are considered religious. that the religiosity of Palin and McCain are taken more at face value than Obama's religious convictions. And she feels that Democrats have a much higher bar to clear in proving that they're religious. And the media have bought into this in the oversimplified language of the media. Values have been defined exclusively in terms, almost exclusively in terms of anti-abortion and anti-gay marriage. And she was saying that she's very unhappy with this, and so did the second person interviewed, Rod Dreher, the conservative, who was very unhappy with having religion, one's religion, religiosity defined in terms of these two issues. She recounted how at this conference of at this conservative church, Saddleback Church, where Rick Warren was interviewing the two candidates, and he asked both about salvation. Specifically, first he asked, that do you believe that Jesus is the way, the light, and the life, or something like that, is a famous saying. And Obama said, I believe that he is my way and light and life. But she pointed out that he is of the conviction that God would not exclude from heaven his mother, who was not religious, but he felt deeply moral. And then this Rick Warren, who wrote The Purpose-Driven Life, he asked, when does life begin? And when do human rights begin in a baby? So already it's loaded by referring to a using the word baby, which used to imply after birth, but now has come to mean not be limited to that. So he asked Obama that, and Obama said, whether you're looking at it from a theological perspective or a scientific perspective, answering that question with specificity is above my pay grade. And then the conservatives, I suppose, especially the conservative evangelicals, pounced on that and saw that as being evasive. But it became a big soundbite that was trumpeted all over the media when he said it's above my pay grade. But then he went on, what we didn't hear much from the media was he went on to give a multi-part reflection on the moral dimensions of the abortion question. And then when McCain was asked the same question, when do human rights begin in a baby? He said simply, at conception. And then he was asked another question. He also gave a very simple answer. And one of these two, I can't remember which, whether it was Amy Sullivan or Rod Dreher, pointed out this seems to be one of the differences in sensibility between liberals and conservatives, is that liberals tend to give more complex and nuanced answers, whereas what conservatives want to hear, at least some evangelical conservatives, is simple, clear, bam, there's the answer right there. I think most of us in Zen have a problem with simple, certainly simplistic answers. But we're not the only ones. At this year's Republican convention, or excuse me, Democratic convention, a Catholic bishop, Bishop Charles Blake of the Church of God in Christ, said, "I'm a Democrat because I want to help those already born." And in the 2006 platform of the Democratic Party, it was the first time, according to Amy Sullivan, it was the first time that the Democratic Party platform explicitly promoted health care, income support, and adoption policies that would support a woman choosing to have a baby. Now, then, for the second interview, this was again of this Rod Dreher, who wrote a book called "Crunchy Cons," and this is the subtitle: "How Birkenstock Birkians, Gun-Loving Organic Gardeners, Evangelical Free-Range Farmers, Hip Homeschool Mamas, Right-wing nature lovers, and their diverse tribe of countercultural conservatives plan to save America, or at least the Republican Party." This guy is a columnist and a blogger for the Dallas Morning News, and had previously written for the New York Post and the National Review. The latter certainly is a conservative magazine. And he clearly with pride considers himself a conservative, but one who has become increasingly unhappy with the Republican Party. It began when he began thinking, becoming aware of this dissatisfaction when he was writing for the National Review, and he told his editor that he was going to pick up his family's box of organic vegetables from which they had ordered from this cooperative farm. And her response was, "Ooh, that's so lefty." And it got him to thinking, why is that lefty to want to eat well? And as he was thinking on the train out of New York to pick up this box of vegetables, he looked down at his Birkenstock sandals on his feet, and he then came to the conclusion over the following weeks that there were things about him and his family that, as he said, put us off the Republican reservation. And he mentioned as examples wearing Birkenstocks, preferring to patronize little shops, not big box stores, and also patronizing small family farms, as well as having a countercultural stance toward consumerism. And then he wrote an essay for the online version of the National Review expressing these sensibilities. And he got what he called a gratifying and shocking response from those who felt they were the same, that they had some of these same values that are usually ascribed to liberals, but still consider themselves conservatives. He mentioned one guy who wrote to him and said, "I'm a Buddhist Republican, and I just want to invite George Bush over for a bowl of dal and talk policy with me." Good luck. And then he said, "I don't fit in with," and this guy said in his letter to Dreher, he said, "I don't fit in with the Republican Party, but the Democrats won't have me because I'm pro-life." So let's now get into this abortion issue. Dreher went on to say that he really admires and likes Obama a lot as a person, but that he can't vote for him because what does he say here? That he can't accept Obama's position that nothing should stand in the way of a woman's right to an abortion. And then Dreher points out that he feels that there are these two irreconcilable positions. Either you believe that life and personhood and legal and moral rights begins at conception, or it doesn't. And then Dreher goes on to say, this is like, this would be like saying, raising the question of whether a black person in the South, I'm quoting him, is a human being or not. And he mentions this as this analogy to say that the compromise is untenable in this. Either yes or no, and there's nothing in between. And this takes us back to the appreciation in conservatism of simple black and white stands on things and answers. But is it so black and white, this abortion issue? And why should we accept these basic terms that have been accepted by the culture at large for these two sides, as if Democrats are not pro-life, and as if Republicans or conservatives are against choice of any kind? See, the media, we know this, don't we? That the media loves to simplify things and oversimplify things. They're dealing with viewers and listeners with very short attention spans, just generally these days, who have a remote in their hand and can just flip from channel to channel, and they have to keep it simple, and overly simple, I would say. Anyone who's ever seen even just a brief piece on television or radio, or even an article that is about something you know a lot about, discovers that the media is grossly oversimplifies things, and often distorts and completely mangles things. I'm always horrified when I see what the media does with Buddhism and Zen. I think an exception to that was this recent article in the local paper, the Democrat and Chronicle, by Mark Hare, who I think did maybe the best article I've seen in a long time about Buddhism, showing some of the complexities of it and all. But we can't rely on the media to portray things in a sophisticated or even fully truthful way, because they just are looking for not only black and white presentations, but controversy. Just a little more before we get into abortion specifically. This Rod Dreher says that there is a divide between American religious sides. The conservatives or traditionalists who believe in an objective moral truth that's transcendental and knowable through the Bible or through one's church. That's the what he calls the conservatives or the traditionalists versus the progressives who believe that religious truth is something that can be reinterpreted to suit the demands of the particular situation in society, such as abortion or gay marriage. And he calls this a very deep and fundamental division. And he feels it speaks to what it means to be religious. I think we can bridge this gap, but not in a way that it might satisfy him, which is to, I would submit, that that there is a fundamental truth that is transcendental, and that is something that is not static, not fixed, and is not an abstraction that can be pointed to as something outside human interpretation, that it includes this moral truth, this transcendental moral truth includes human interpretation, exigencies. And that's why abortion is such a tricky topic. He goes on to say that, and I think this may be true, I don't know, as much as you can make this hard and fast distinction between liberals and conservatives, they said that liberals find the search and the seeking to be so important, whereas religious conservatives put their emphasis on the finding. My mind goes immediately to the Roshi Kaplow's the dedication statement in Roshi Kaplow's book, Zen Merging of East and West, where he says, dedicated not to those who seek, but to those who find. And I think of a certain type of person, there are many these days, who derive a lot of satisfaction, and I would suggest pride, from going around to lectures by people like Eckhart Tolle and Jill Bolte Taylor and Byron Katie, who I suspect don't go, most of these people don't take it beyond their attendance at these things and make it a real serious practice. And I would suppose that many of these people are very proud to say that they are seekers. This is an old thing we've heard from for decades, since the 60s, this pride in seeking. And that was what Roshi Kaplow was addressing in his dedication, was not that there's anything wrong with seeking. In a way, you could say that the practice, Zen practice, in the deepest sense, is endless seeking for this full realization that seems something that is unattainable in the ultimate sense. Is always further to go. In that sense, we can admire this spirit of endlessly, this endless aspiration to go beyond ourselves and to find and to embody ultimate truth as we may understand it. And here too, in the interview of this Rajreya, she again brings up the same phrase that she brought up with Amy Sullivan, which is, there seems to be between liberals and conservatives a difference in sensibility. And he said yes, he thinks that's true, which allows all of us on the political spectrum to hear the same thing while not hearing the same thing at all. I really did. I did really respond favorably to this conservative guy, Rod Dreher. He sounded like a really sincere and humble guy who acknowledged a lot of his own failings, and something between the words of what he was saying prompted a really positive response from me. I think he more than Amy Sullivan articulated the need to get beyond political differences and find our common humanity. Some of you have heard me say this from this seat, that politics is such a potentially divisive topic, more so than ever. I read that older people who say that they've seen this drift toward in public conversation and socializing to avoid speaking about politics because people have become so polarized and so passionate and can so easily get angry in political discussions. And I know that from my own experience. Falling prey to that, and we need to strive to do better, to not be blinded by these political differences, blinded to our what we have in common, which is far, far more than our differences. He says that he feels that he's now more interested in being religious and culturally engaged than politically engaged. He says that there's too much involvement in politics and too little in culture, that we should work more to build up cultural institutions, to get engaged in creative endeavors. He's talking about conservatives. And then he said he doesn't see that getting Republicans elected over and over again has managed to conserve anything. And then he ends by saying that he refers to Amy Sullivan, the liberal evangelical who was interviewed the previous week, and says, Amy Sullivan is one of my friends. I disagree with her on almost everything, but I like spending time with her more than with people I may agree with politically, but who don't recognize our common humanity. And this is what inspired me about these two interviews, is that seems to be what they have in common, these two representatives of these two sides, and something that I think in Zazen we can actualize more and more in degrees, that the more we can delve into this mind that is beyond division, certainly beyond politics, but beyond all divisions. This is the realm of no mind, the realm that is beyond conceptual divisions, thoughts. The more we can confirm for ourselves what is common to us, and has there ever been a greater need for that than these days? He actually says that He says he's one of the many new conservatives now who see morality as not beginning and ending with abortion and gay marriage. He spoke with deep feeling about how anguished he is to see conservatives not speaking out against torture. And he said that he sees the Republican Party as distinguished from the broader category of conservatives, but he sees the Republican Party as having two main interests, defense issues and business issues. So that's where he takes issue with Republicans who have this more narrow focus. In the interview, Krista Tippett, the hostess, played a clip of some guy, and I missed who it was, but someone, clearly a Republican, who was gushing over McCain's pick of Palin, and he said that, referring to her, she said she's right down the middle, rock solid, pro-life, pro-capital punishment, pro-adoption, pro-traditional marriage. John McCain hit a grand slam when he picked her. Recently, I talked to one of our members who suffered a loss recently and began, somehow the loss, this very, very deep loss to someone very close to her, that reawakened in her a guilt over an abortion she had had 15 years ago. And so this is just fresh in my mind to hear how much anguish a woman can have following an abortion, and how complicated this issue is. So let me offer some perspectives on this. Pro-life. To use the term pro-life implies that those who are for abortion rights are anti-life, and that is a really specious claim to make and a very limited perspective. I'm going to actually, in the interest of conveying a lot of complex material succinctly, I'm going to read from the passage in Roshi Kaplow's Zen Merging of East and West where he tackles this issue of abortion. And I'm just going to read it because everything he says here, I think, is so beautifully, thoughtfully presented, and I agree with it. He says it much more succinctly than I can in this talk. The issue of abortion, as you know, has long been the subject of bitter public debate. At one extreme are those who insist all life is sacred, even a human embryo. These people rage against the, quote, murderous mind of those who would deny, quote, the right of life of the unborn child, insisting that since only God can give life, only he can take it away. And then this is the question I think is so important. He says, it may be asked, are these same individuals just as vociferous in demanding a decent life for those already born, who are undernourished and exploited? And this is the hopeful direction that conservatism, from my point of view, it's hopeful, is taking, in that there are more and more conservatives who are willing to come out publicly and give greater weight to social issues that involve life beyond life for those already born. There are more even evangelicals who are saying, okay, abortion is an important issue, but so is war and poverty and hunger and the environment and child care, elder care, the care of the handicapped, health care, infant mortality, human rights, torture, even animal rights. And it's always just been such a puzzle to me how it is that people who are so passionate about the anti-abortion cause, as far as I can tell, they seem to be, it seems to be limited. Their great passion for the right to life seems to be so limited to the unborn. I got a little understanding of this from an article in the Atlantic Monthly. This is a long time ago, 1990, but I don't think this is something that is topical. It goes on and on. This is by Mary Gordon. And she says, regarding the difficulties of this abortion debate, the difficulties stem, of course, from the odd situation of a fetus's ontology, a complicated, differentiated, and nuanced response is required when we are dealing with an entity that changes over time. We are in the habit of making distinctions like this. At one point, we know that a child is no longer a child, but an adult. That this question is vexed and problematic is clear from our difficulty in determining who is a juvenile offender and who is an adult criminal and what age sexual intercourse ceases to be known as statutory rape. So at what point, if any, do we on the pro-choice side say that the developing fetus is a person with rights equal to its mother? She goes on to say, because abortion will always deal with what it is to create and sustain life, it will always be a moral issue. And whether we like it or not, our moral thinking about abortion is rooted in the shifting soil of perception. In an age in which much of our perception is manipulated by media that specialize in the soundbite and the photo op, the anti-choice partisans have a twofold, and she calls it anti-choice. The anti-choice partisans have a twofold advantage over us on the pro-choice side. The pro-choice moral position is more complex, and the experience we defend is physically repellent to contemplate. None of us in the pro-choice movement would suggest that abortion is not a regrettable occurrence. Anti-choice proponents can offer pastel photographs of babies and buntings, their eyes peaceful in the camera's gaze. In answer, we can't offer the material of an early abortion, bloody, amorphous in a paper cup, to prove that what has just been removed from the woman's body is not a child, not in the same category of being as the adorable bundle in an adoptive mother's arms. It is not a pleasure to look at the physical evidence of abortion, and most of us don't get the opportunity to do so. I think this is, I'm just going to say this, I think that the anti-abortion, or shall we say anti-choice side, really pulled off a brilliant move when they changed the terms of the debate to refer to the embryo or the fetus as a child. Historically, childhood starts with birth, and that they have gotten the media to accept that term, the unborn child, was brilliant in terms of advancing their own point of view. Yes, I would say, and I think Buddhism the Buddhist position would be that life begins at conception. That's life. Conception begets life in a very incipient, very tentative form, but it's life. How can we say it's not life? But the question is, what kind of life is it? It's not independent life. That starts at birth. And that, I would suggest, is what we should limit the term child to, is independent, the first moment of independent life, when the baby takes its first breath. Now we got a baby on our hands. Before that, yes, it's life. And therefore, we want to avoid taking life when the reasons to, when it makes sense to, when it's for the greater good. Let's put it that way. That's generally speaking the Mahayana position. The Mahayana criterion is, what is the greatest good for the greatest number? And that's what gets us into the complexities of this. This author, Mary Gordon, goes on to say, because issues of pregnancy and birth are both physical and metaphorical, we must constantly step back and forth between ways of perceiving the world. When we speak of gestation, we are often talking in terms of potential, about events and objects to which we attach our hopes, fears, dreams, and ideals. I think this is goes partway to explaining why these people who are out on at abortion clinics in the middle of winter, freezing to death, can do this day after day, and who sincerely, passionately feel so strongly about this. Objects to which we attach our hopes, fears, dreams, and ideals. A mother can speak to the fetus in her uterus and name it. She and her mate may decorate a nursery according to their vision of the good life. They may choose for an embryo a college, a profession, a dwelling. But those of us who are trying to think morally about pregnancy and birth must remember that these feelings are our own projections onto what is in reality an inappropriate object. However charmed we may be by an expectant father's buying a little football for something inside his wife's belly, we shouldn't make public policy based on such actions, nor should we force others to live their lives conforming to our fantasies. As a society, she goes on, we are making decisions that pit the complicated future of a complex adult against the fate of a mass of cells lacking cortical development. The moral pressure should be on distinguishing the true from the false, the real suffering of living persons from our individual and often idiosyncratic dreams and fears. We must make decisions on abortion based on an understanding of how people really do live. Another section here. These uncertainties can lead to another set of fears, not only about abortion, but about its implications. Many anti-choice people fear that to support abortion is to cast one's lot with the cold and technological rather than with the warm and natural, to head down the slippery slope toward a brave new world where handicapped children are left on mountains to starve and the old are put out in the snow. But if we look at the history of abortion, we don't see the embodiment of what the anti-choice proponents fear. On the contrary, accepting the grotesque counterexample of the People's Republic of China, which practices forced abortion, there seems to be a real link between repressive anti-abortion stances and repressive governments. Abortion was banned in fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. It is illegal in South Africa and in Chile. It is paid for by the governments of Denmark, England, and the Netherlands which have national health and welfare systems that foster the health and well-being of mothers, children, the old, and the handicapped. Now, setting aside this article and going back to a Buddhist position or Zen Buddhist position on abortion, I just can't get my mind around those who say that the woman should not be the one to decide about whether to have an abortion, that it's the government that should ratify this. I suppose there are people who would say, well, wait a minute, what about murder? Would you say that it's every individual's choice whether to commit murder or not, but it shouldn't be outlawed? But again, it's not the same. To say that we should respect women to make that decision is not to say that it's something that's not regrettable. Of course it is. It's taking life. Of course it's regrettable. But let the woman make that choice about whether to take life. And then on the other side, I'll go back to what Roshi says here. Roshi Kaplow. On the other side are those who insist that the pregnant woman alone has the right to decide whether to bear the fetus. To women who cry, "This is my body. I can do with it as I please," I would ask, how can you say it is your body when you cannot control the circulation of your blood or your heartbeat, your thoughts, aging, or death? Clearly, your body has its own laws which it obeys independently of your wishes. True, in a limited sense, it is your body, for it is the outcome of your karma, of your volitional thoughts and actions in this life and previous ones. But don't forget that your karma also includes your biological inheritance from your parents. He goes on, make no mistake, abortion is a grave matter. Even when the danger of the mother's physical death is remote, as in a modern clinic, the spiritual dying that accompanies an abortion can be real and painful. For a spiritually sensitive woman who realizes she is the means through which a particular being can be reborn in human form, that form which is so hard to obtain, to acquiesce in the aborting of that incipient life can be a soul-scarring experience, just as bearing a wanted child in happy circumstances can be a source of tremendous joy. Many women, and men too, have asked my advice about abortion. I have seen and heard the delight of those who, though having contemplated an abortion, decided to have the child, and I have observed sorrow etched in the faces of many who did have an abortion. To comment here, it is in recognition of the regrets and the anguish that so commonly follows an abortion, that a few years ago we began having a ceremony, usually once a year, that is done in Japanese Zen, Japanese Buddhism, that the translation is a water baby ceremony. And in this water baby ceremony, any woman or man who feels a need to come to terms with either an abortion or a miscarriage or an early childhood death can participate. And I've been told by those who have attended this ceremony that it can be remarkably healing. And then he goes on to talk about a woman who was so relieved that she, after having the child, she was so relieved she didn't have the abortion. But But then he says, having heard this, you should not conclude that abortion in all circumstances is a violation of the first precept, for this would be a grievous misunderstanding. While Buddhism on the whole decries the destruction of any form of life, the Mahayana experience nonetheless sees the right to life as not absolute. And then he goes on, this is, he goes on to talk at length, right at length, about the population explosion and all of the struggle for dwindling food supplies and famines and pestilence, chaos and wars and so forth, as a reason to be sure that if you're pregnant, you're ready to care for the baby. And then he ends by saying, at this point, some of you are undoubtedly thinking, you have discussed the pros and cons of abortion, but if I am faced with an unwanted pregnancy, on what should I base a decision? How can I be certain that what I decide to do is right and will not produce painful karma? And I'll take it in from here. There is no absolute certainty, no absolute right or wrong, no clear-cut solution. The best thing you can do when facing such a decision is to sit as deeply as you possibly can, to allow the decision to emerge on its own, to get beneath the surface waves of thoughts of right and wrong, good and bad, and getting into Zazen as deeply as possible. This is where we are most likely to get in touch with what needs to be done. To get in touch with what needs to be done. Not what I want, or even what I need. There's the I. The I it's not a big enough perspective when the I is there. But to get beneath the I, beyond the I, and try become attuned to what is called for and what is the greatest good for the greatest number. Well, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.